Our topic this morning is closely related to my first lecture, in which we tried to understand the religious and cultural for saintliness or sainthood in Islam. In that lecture, I tried to emphasize that in the Quran, there is a human aspect of Muhammad is emphasized all through. So you don't get the sense of Muhammad being anything more than a human being who is who has received some revelation, and as such he is supposed to guide the community, create the community, and lead it. But as we read the history and the biography of the Prophet, the earliest biographies do indicate that while he was still living, there was already a sense in which Muhammad was seen in a way a mediator, although the Quran does not say it. He was seen as someone who would intercede on behalf of the sinners. He is seen as a person who stands out as being able to perform the miracles, but is not performing the miracles, although he's being challenged quite often in the Arabian, in Meccan context in the 7th century. In the Quran, I find two places where Muhammad's extraordinary religious role is being spelled out in a very interesting way. In chapter 4, Surah An-Nisa, the chapter is entitled Women. In this ayah, the verse number 64, it says, it talks about the role of the Prophet in the society. It says, وَمَا أَرْسَلْنَا مِن رَسُولٍ إِلَّا لِيُتَاعَ بِإِذْنِ اللَّهِ. We haven't sent a prophet but to be obeyed. But his obedience is dependent upon God's permission. So it's a God-given authority, and therefore it should be obeyed by the people. But then it says that if you have wronged yourself, that means if you have sinned, the terminology is if you have sinned too much and you lose hope, you despair, then it says جَاءُوكَ فَاسْتَغْفَرُ اللَّهَ وَاسْتَغْفَرَ لَهُمُ الرَّسُولُ. You come to the Prophet, as if Prophet is an institution. You come to the Prophet, you seek forgiveness from God, and also the Prophet should seek forgiveness on your behalf. A kind of a mediator role. Not only you do, it says, فَاسْتَغْفَرُ اللَّهَ. You seek forgiveness from God. وَاسْتَغْفَرَ لَهُمُ الرَّسُولُ, which in Arabic grammar will say that this is the subject of the verb. And the Prophet seeks forgiveness on behalf of these people, then لَوَجَدُ اللَّهَ تَوَّابًا رَحِيمًا. Then you will find God most forgiving and accepting the repentance of the sinner. The Prophet in the middle is a very interesting situation. Indeed, this verse of the Quran is being now debated in the Muslim society, where there's a special movement in Egypt to cut down the role of the Prophet in between. There is a very strong movement among the young people, and this has even caught up in Iran, by the way. Iran, Egypt, and some other places, it's a new movement. Khalaf Rashid is the leader of the movement, and he says, God is talking directly to the people without the Prophet's mediatorship in between. So there's no need to all the time go back to the Sunnah, to the example of the Prophet. The Quran is made to speak to each one of us. Now this movement goes contrary to what the Quran is trying to say, that no, the Prophet also has a role as a sacred individual. There's another place again in the Quran. The first one, women, Surah An-Nisa number 64. And then this is in Surah Al-Munafiqun, the hypocrites, and ayah number 5. Verse number 5, it says, وَإِذَا قِيلَ لَهُمْ تَعَالَوْ يَسْتَغْفِرْ لَكُمْ رَسُولُ اللَّهِ لَوَّوْ رُؤُوسَهُمْ. وَرَأَيْتُمْ يَسُدُّونَ وَهُمْ مُسْتَكْبِرُونَ. When they are told, تعالوا, come, the prophet of God will seek forgiveness for you. Not that you will forgive, you will seek forgiveness directly from God. The prophet, you come to the prophet and he will seek forgiveness for you from God. Oh, at that time, what do they do? لَبَّرُوسُهُمْ, they turn their faces. And you find them very proud and arrogant. That means they don't want to come to the prophet. Two places, and there are several other references in the Quran, whereby the prophet's role is enhanced from being simply an authority, religious authority, some kind of mediatorship, whereby his recommendation is acceptable to God because of his status as the prophet of God. In the collection of the poems, the first poem that was sung when the prophet entered Medina, and later on this became the famous poem, it is known as Al-Burda. It's a very famous poem. I think it is, if you go, I haven't numbered the pages, but there is a page with Joseph and Zuleika. I think one before the last. Yeah, it's the last one. Actually the last one. The Burda poem is down there. Muhammad, the Lord of the two worlds and of men and jinn, of the two communities, the Arabs and the non-Arabs, our prophet who commands and prohibits, and not a single one is more truthful than he in saying no or yes. And he is the beloved for whose intercession one hopes in every horror and in hazardous undertaking. He has called us to God, and those who cling to him are grasping a rope that cannot be severed. He surpassed the prophets in bodily form and character, and they came not close to him in knowledge nor in kindness. There is a long poem. So there is already some kind of sacredness being attached to the prophet. I want to now play a song for you. It's about the prophet. This was during the early days of Iranian revolution here in Iran. So I want you to understand that Muhammad is being appropriated at different times for different reasons, but more in line with our own search for universal paradigm of who exactly is the inspiring saint. Let's hear the song. Try to remember from the simple Muhammad of this Quran to this Muhammad.
from the what I am trying to connect us ourselves to is the is a paradigm that can be appropriated at different times in history in a different way. But how does that paradigm become accessible? A paradigm that is very austere, very stern, as a human being requiring obedience. When you read, the more you read the Sharia, the more you get the sense in which Muhammad is presented as a legal scholar. He is Moses-like prophet who says, this is what you are supposed to do. Don't try to do anything other than what God has commanded you to do. Something of that nature. And then all of a sudden you have this change to Jesus-like Muhammad. And truly, in Sufism, Jesus is the paradigm par excellence. You see, he is the spiritual individual. He is the one from whom the word Suf is derived. Because it is the description of the clothes of Jesus that is described in the Sufi literature. There's a new book that has come out by Tarif Khalidi, the Jesus of Muslim Gospel. And it's true, Jesus of Muslim Gospel is very different Jesus. And it's the Jesus that Muslims have portrayed. And sometimes it meets the standards of New Testament, sometimes it doesn't. It has its own flavor. What we are seeing here is how a tradition develops into a highly spiritual movement to conduct its appeal to the different temperaments among the followers. And this is what I've done with the presentation. The title of the presentation today is From Nubuwa to Wilaya. That's fine. Yeah, I don't know if it will make any difference. It might not make that much difference because the light is also from this side. Yeah, so it won't make much difference. Anyway, I think we are at least satisfied to have it on the screen today. From prophethood, and I'll loosely translate wilaya, to the sainthood. Wilaya, we know, means the friendship with God. That's wilaya. But as a technical term, we will employ the Christian terminology here to make it more, I think, understandable, that what we are talking about is a transformation of a prophet-like figure to the wilaya. In other words, what we are looking at is the development of devotional dimensions of the prophet's life. It's very different than the prophet's life as a prophet. From religious authority, which is very much centered in the Quran, now you're looking at prophet as someone who's accessible to the people, accessible to average individuals at the level of love, at the level of pain, at the level of all kinds of connection that human beings seek emotionally. Let's look at this passage here. It's a description of Muhammad by an early companion of Muhammad. O holy man of God, the reference is to the Prophet Muhammad himself. See how the tone changes. The Quran has no such references. But the tradition has those references. O holy man of God, you are generous and the aim of our journey is your inviolate sanctuary, haram. We want to enter your haram. We want to enter that security. Fate has frightened us with its blows and we have come to ask for favor from your highness. We open our hands to beseech you for the return of our happiness in reunion. Yes, in reunion. The terms are very important. With our dear ones in the distant homeland. That Allah alayhim. We use your pure dust for intercession and to serve to approach the omniscient who hears all. Many strangers came to this place and achieve prompt favor with God and happiness. I want you to imagine, where could this passage have been said? Where? Where would be the place to say such thing? In his tomb.
So it is at Medina then. The passage is said in Medina when you enter the courtyard of the mosque. We have rituals. From the time you leave your hotel today in Medina, and by the time you enter the first gate and come to the second gate and to the third entrance, so to speak, to the threshold, you have different stages, you have different prayers. This is one of the things that you say in your prayer, that this is the man of God who can then intercede on your behalf. So intercession is an extremely important issue. When you are threatened in your life, when you don't have much hope, you despair for the wrongs that happen. What should you do? Should you become hopeless or should you build on something? And here the prophet's paradigm changes into wilaya. How the prophethood becomes the wilaya. But what my argument is that the Quran does foresee it. In the very verses that we cited about the role of the prophet in seeking the forgiveness for the people, I think there's already an implication. If you move it to its logical conclusion, then it's not far-fetched to think that this is what you would say when you entered the threshold of the prophet himself in Medina. Yes, this is in the books. We have... They have no choice. Because you can read anything. They snatch it from you if they hear it aloud. But they can't stop you from using it.
Yeah, but who? Everyone recites this?
Yes. We have a standard recitation when we reach the prophet's mosque. And there are standard books like I saw yesterday in Samuel's tomb. We have special prayer books that we use when we go pray and do the salutations, greet the prophet, peace. All these are very standardized. And then when you have the guides, who are Saudi guides, who take you around to see all these tombs, they say exactly those prayers, which we sometimes wonder if the Wahhabis would ever approve those. But these are standard texts. They can't fight against them. Distant homelands, if you are in Medina, then your family members are the ones whom you have missed. You might not be with your family members. You might be alone. You might be only two of you, husband and wife, the children are away or something. So there is always this concern. Jam'a shumulina is a very common prayer when you travel. When you travel, you pray for your children who are away from you. So this is what you do. But this is one of the samples, by the way, several such beautiful passages in the prayer books. There's a good reference that you might want to look up in your library somewhere. Constance Pedwick, she wrote a book on Muslim devotions. And she has section on the Muslims, what they say when they visit the grave of the prophet. And she has for other imams. And it's a beautiful book, by the way. Constance Pedwick has done a beautiful job of translating and making those things available for us to see. Prophethood is introduced definitely, as I've mentioned even in my first lecture, that there is the servanthood of the prophet that is being emphasized in the Quran. The prophet is always a servant, abd. And again, in the reference to the Quran, a servant to whom revelation has been given. So there is no distinction between Muhammad and other human beings, except for the revelation. A human being granted a revelatory experience. The question will come up later on, can this experience be repeated by you and me as ordinary people? It will come up and we'll see what are the responses given to it. The prophet is made to say constantly in the Quran, not only once, in several places, say, I do not say, with me are the treasures of God, and I do not know the invisible, hidden things. I have no knowledge about it. And I do not say that I am an angel. I only follow that which is revealed to me. So that's the limit. What is revealed to me remains open to interpretation by the followers. And in different contexts, people have
asserted different things. What is revealed to him? Does he know about the future events? What kind of future events has he predicted? So these are something that that is worked out in the knowledge of the... There are books written, Ilmul Anbiya. What do the prophets know? How much do they know? This is a very large theological discussion. The Quran and the Prophet himself, as the tradition says, the authentic tradition reports constantly, the only miracle is the Quran. And truly, yes, there is the miracle that is open to all kinds of appropriation at different times. Its implications, as I say, that you can really follow the thesis followed by Khalaf Rashid in Egypt, that the Prophet has no role except to be a conveyor of the message, the one who has delivered the message, and nothing more than that. And you can reduce the Prophet's role to that, or you can raise it to the level where we are seeing that how the wilaya of the Prophet himself becomes an issue that is so important in the life of the Prophet, in the life of the community. But what are the basic points which are used for the veneration of the Prophet? What is it that makes it possible for the Muslims to seek those interpretations which lead us to somehow veneration of the Prophet? And the Prophet is very much venerated. His love, you don't mention the Prophet's name without sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam. God's blessings and peace be upon him. You always do that with that kind of reverence, that you don't even mention his name without the proper blessings. So you have certain basic things that are taught in the tradition itself about the veneration. First of the things that has been constantly referred to by the Sufis and other Muslims is that Rahmatun lil Alameen, he is a mercy to the worlds. He's a mercy for the worlds, or for the Arabic translation is, he's the mercy for the universe of the beings. And wherever there is life, he's the mercy for them. So that's one of the sources for the veneration of the Prophet. The second source is Uswatun Hasana, of noble character, noble nature. لَقَدْ كَانَ لَكُمْ فِي رَسُولِ اللَّهِ أُسْوَةٌ حَسَنَةٌ. We have created in the Prophet an example for you. And that noble nature, that noble character, the search for it leads us to the devotional dimensions automatic, because it's an emotional connection that you are seeking. And that emotional connection is very different than the legal connection. Yes, the legal paradigms are there, but the devotional paradigms go beyond the legal paradigms. One of the most important that we saw also in the Burda. Why do we obey the Prophet? Because he is the one who will lead you. He is the one who knows what we should be doing, what we should not be doing. Therefore, he should be obeyed. Obedience to the Prophet has led to the messenger, has led to that kind of devotion. Obedience could not be required of an example that was corrupt. It has to be some kind of perfect example. Then only you can follow that kind of person. So that also has functioned as a very important issue. Again, one of the most important issues in the Quran is the love of God. Okay, we claim to love God. Everybody says, I love God. But what is the proof that you love God? And the Quran is putting it very, if you love God, then you follow the Prophet. Then you use his footsteps to see objectively how you should be loving God. So love of God is not a subjective matter. In the Quran, it's a very objective matter, and it is seeking, I think, a very clear understanding that that subjective element in our claim of love should be converted to objective action. So it says, if you love God, follow me. And there is a very interesting here twist in Arabic. It doesn't say ati'uni, it says attabi'uni. Attabi'uni is different from ati'uni. You do the ita' in opinions. You can follow somebody's opinion. You can intellectually be following someone. But when you say ittiba, you are following someone's footstep. That means you are following somebody's action. And the Quran uses the term attabi'uni rather than ati'uni. Just, you don't obey me in what I am saying in my thoughts, but you obey through the action. You follow my footsteps. And it says that then only God will love you and will forgive you your shortcomings. So you have a standard being provided in the Quran itself. From Nubuwa, then the wilaya is actually here. The Quran does not use the word Walaya, for the love here, is hub. The normal term hub, ishq, is a letter term added by the Sufis. Hallaj is the first one to use the word ishq, which means passionate love, burning love. Hub is more passive. It's not active love. It's when you say an habbak, I love you, it doesn't mean I actively seek you out. It is a passive recognition. But when you say ashaqni, therefore in the Arabic songs today, the word is not hub, it is ashaq. If you hear the songs of Amr Diab, the most popular of the singers, he doesn't use hub because hub is too weak to express our modern passionate love, you know, of anything. So here it is that the Quran uses that passive verb in order to say that love is passive, God's love, but it becomes active only when you act it out according to the Prophet's paradigm. I see this as a very important source for the veneration of the Prophet. It's not only looking for the example, but almost adoring it. How would you obey it if you don't love it? And Ghazali has a book. He says that you can never love God without first obeying God. So there's this battle between love and obedience. Can you claim that I love God when you don't obey God? So you don't take God's love for granted. You really need to show through action. The other part that the Quran introduces, I think it's more the tradition that does it, that the Prophet is, and in the song we heard it quite a few times, Ya Noor-e Khuda. Noor-e Khuda is the light of God. O light of God. O Muhammad, you are the light of God. You have come to defeat the darkness. So that light of God, this devotion to Muhammad means the imitation of the Noorul Huda, that means the light of guidance. And that Noorul Huda then becomes a very important terminology in the mystical Islam, in the Sufi Islam, because there you have Noorul Huda, the light of the right guidance, and you have to seek it out. And Noorul Huda is, most of the commentators of the Quran would say that Noorul Huda is the Quran itself. So you have to go back to the Quran, like the Khalaf Rashid people would say, that you are supposed to go back to the Quran, not to the Prophet. But what happens here is that in the traditional commentaries of the Quran, Muhammad is never separated from the Quran. In fact, most of our commentators would say, you will never understand the Quran without Muhammad. So you need to keep Muhammad and the Quran together in order to understand it. So Noorul Huda is not only the Quran, but also the Muhammad who exemplifies the Quran. Now you look at the poetry that about, this is the poetry that's going, Sa'aduna Umma Sa'ad in the 13th century. When he talks about the Prophet, look at the way the Quran sees and the Muslims see their Prophet in connection with the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible prophets. Your light was in Joseph's beauty. O light of God, it healed Jacob's blind eye so that it became well. I shall kiss the image if I do not find a way to kiss the prophet's sandal. Perhaps the good fortune of kissing it will be granted to me in paradise in the most radiant place. And I rub my heart on it so that perhaps the burning thirst which rages in it may be quenched. And Sa'aduna is one of the Sufi leaders, but also among the ulama, because he has also written books on the law. So you find that it was not a separate category like it has become in the modern times. If you heard the talk on that day about Sufism, the Imam, the Sheikh, who was trying to say that we have these Sufi orders are weak in the Sharia. They don't know much about the Sharia. They don't. So this, I think, is more in the pre-modern days, in 16th, 17th, 18th century, is more of that kind of separation. Up to 13th, 14th century, you find the Sufi sheikhs were also mutakallimun, they were theologians, they were also legal scholars. So they were both. And in that, this is what is, I think, important to remember in this citation here, that Sa'aduna is also a faqih. He's a jurist, as much as a person who's looking at the Prophet as in a very devotional terms. This is what I see as a transformation that took, it started from 8th century, 9th century, and it was really perfected. Because in Hallaj's poems also, you have Muhammad's explanation is very, very different. It's the burning love that Muhammad is inspiring. Whereas in the tradition, it is not known as that. But that's what the devotion does. The two titles that are used for the Prophet interchangeably in the writings and also in the Quran. One is the Khalil and the other is the Habib. Khalil is a friend. Habib is the beloved. So Khalil, Hebron. The title of Abraham in the Quran is Ibrahim Khalilullah, the friend of God. Therefore you use the term Khalil here as Khulla, Khalla is to be close, intimate to someone. Therefore Ibrahim in the Quranic tradition is Khalilullah. That means he came very, very close to God. Habib is beloved of God. When you see Khalil is earned, Habib is given as a gift. That's the difference between the two. Khulla is you are tested and you earn it. Abraham in the Quranic tradition, the Quranic story, goes through the testing. And when he is tested by God, that's the time when the covenant is mentioned in the Quran between God and Abraham. And the covenant is very interestingly put, it is more messianic by the way. It talks about the future coming of the good leaders in the community, in the ummah, in the community. Because he says, وَاجْعَلْنِي إِمَامًا مِنْ ذُرِّيَةِ فِي ذُرِّيَةِ. Make imams among my zuriya, among my descendants, O God. Abraham is praying to God and God says, yes. لَا يَنَالُ أَحْدِيَ الظَّالِمِينَ. My covenant does not cover the wrongdoers. They will not be able to rule. So that is the covenant. After that examination, Ibrahim is given the title of Khulla, Khalil. Habib is given the title, not directly in the Quran, but in the tradition. So Habib is the title that is earned. Uniqueness of Muhammad's title is God's close friend, Khalil. God's beloved friend. Muhammad's protection from sinful deviation, we've already seen in the first lecture, that Isma was a very important issue. How the leader had to be protected by God's special gift, by God's benevolence. As we mentioned, the word was Magdalena. What was the word that we used for the divine protection that was given through Isma? Isma, but there was another word. And you said, oh, this is very close to the German word. Lutf, by the way. R-L-U-T-H. Because the Germans have Luft for the air. But this is, yeah, but this is Lutf, by the way. Just change the consonant and you have this Arabic word, Lutf, which is benevolence, divine grace. And this is partly derived from the titles again, and you find that the titles, both the titles are given in a very elevated sense of the human ascendancy. Human is ascending to the spiritual levels. There's another term, that there's another process which the Prophet is attributed to. Aslama Shaitani. It's very interesting. My Shaitan has become a Muslim. My Satan has become a Muslim. That means he has surrendered. Means he has no control over me anymore. That means I control my Satan. And this is the human goal, by the way. Human perfection is possible when we are able to become egoless. When we can break up. Because ego is satanic. The moment you break your ego, you are able to move on. And this is what it means. My Satan has surrendered indicates transformation by constant spiritual growth in the grace of God. And I'm using here Lutf, by the way. Lutf, this is in the grace of God, in the sense that God is constantly blessing. Those who move one step towards God, God moves 10 steps towards them, as the Quran would say. So if we start moving towards God one step, then God is moving 10 steps towards us. In other words, He is seeking us out even more actively than we are seeking Him out. And how do we do that? We have to conquer the Satan. Again, the Prophet's position is elevated to the position of he has conquered his ego. He has controlled his Satan. And for Umar ibn al-Khattab, the Sunni Muslims would say that Satan used to be frightened by Umar ibn al-Khattab. Whenever he passed away, he passed anywhere, Satan would run away from him. Not only Satan, but also women used to run away from him. Because he was ferocious. He treated women very hard. You know? And so among the caliphs whose reported to have A very strong personality, ferocious one, is Umar ibn al-Khattab, especially in regards to women. Regards to women. Yes. What other thing is emphasized in the spiritual dimension of the Nubuwwah is Muhammad's connection to other prophets. The prophet who is constantly mentioned in the spiritual dimension is Jesus. Muhammad used to call Jesus my brother. Wa akhi Isa ibn Maryam. My brother Isa, the son of Mary. So you have this constant references to the past prophets. Abraham comes very often. Moses comes very often. Moses' connection in the tradition about the prophets is Moses is always regarded as a stern theologian, very strict prophet. Well, Jesus has the other dimension. He has the dimension of what we call sympathy and all. So two of them somehow balance off in the... I'm talking about the Islamic tradition, by the way. In Islamic tradition, Rumi uses Moses always as an example who could not experience mystical dimension of the faith. So the story of Moses is given with the shepherd. It's a very famous story in the Muslim tradition. And Rumi plays on it on several levels. He brings Moses as the one who is requiring strict obedience to what God says and has no tolerance at all when it comes to anything that will hurt monotheism, the divine uniqueness, the divine oneness. And this story of the shepherd has become a kind of a paradigm in the Muslim tradition. Even today, whenever they want to fight what we call ritualism, they mention that story of the shepherd and the Moses. And Moses meets this shepherd when he's talking He's talking to the sheep and saying that, oh God, if you come, I'll comb your hair the way I'm combing the hair of my sheep. And I'll give you a massage. It's in Farsi, it's beautiful. And then he comes to the point, and if you come, I'll even slaughter the sheep and feed you. Moses heard this. Said, my God, what kind of things are you saying? This is blasphemy. It's against God. And the shepherd started weeping. And Moses went away. He was going to receive the revelation from God. And God talks to Moses, said, "Tu barai vasl amadi, na barai fasl. I have sent you to join the hearts of the people to me. I haven't brought you in this world so that you break their hearts and move them away from me." So, and he says, Moses, every people have been given their language in which they refer to me, they talk to me. Leave them alone because they are my lovers. Don't interfere between me and my lovers. Now these stories, where are they taken from? They are the stories that are part of Qasas al-Anbiya, the stories of the Prophet, which is part of the what I call folklorish tradition in Islam, which is derived from the Israeliyat. There are Hebrew sources. Some of the early companions read Hebrew, Syriac, and I was studying these in relation to the Messianic tradition. What kind of language they knew. And we have biographical dictionaries in which these authors are mentioned, what kind of training they had. Who were their teachers? And you hear about the Jewish teachers they had, who taught them Hebrew, with whom they read Bible. So you have quite heterogeneous tradition entering Islam, especially in the Qasas al-Anbiya, the stories of the Prophet, that directly taken from the Jewish sources, from the Hebrew sources, and all kinds of things that were known in the Arabian 7th, 8th century Arabia at that time. So all these prophets and the connections with the other prophets become part of the long spiritual tradition in Islam. How the prophets are united. It's not only the shrines that you find common shrines. If you go to Baghdad, you go to Kufa, there are several prophets, Old Testament prophets, who are buried in Kufa, outside Kufa. And they take you to those shrines because they are Muslim shrines. And the Muslims have taken care of them, have provided the buildings, etc. So you have that kind of tradition going on. But it is more Muhammad's relation to the other prophets that the Quran has actually laid down. Instead of seeing itself as a separate tradition, it sees itself as a continuum in the spiritual development of the entire tradition of the Abrahamic religions. And the Quran says very clearly, we do not distinguish between the prophets. We do not distinguish between the prophets. And that, I think, Islam has an advantage in some ways as being the youngest of the three. It has an advantage of somehow seeing its own tradition, its own message as a continuum rather than as a disjuncture. It doesn't say that, no, we have come here to negate all these things and now we'll establish a new tradition. Or the messianic tradition in Islam does become quite exclusive. And we will talk about it in another connection in this lectures. No, there is no distinction between the prophets who came previously. That means they came with the same message. لَا نُفَرِّقُ بَيْنَهُمْ. We do not make distinctions between them. They all have come with the same message, in other words. What I've quoted here is another source, Najmuddin Daya. Najmuddin Razi Daya is talking about the Prophet now here. The Prophet, upon whom be peace and blessing, said, I have been granted excellence over other prophets in six things. The earth has been made a mosque for me. I find all battles for the mosque meaningless. If you study this tradition, the space for which you should be fighting seems to be meaningless. But this is my interpretation. I want you to be clear so that it doesn't come. It is off record. Although she has recorded, but it's off record. I have been granted excellence over the other prophets in six things. The earth has been made a mosque for me, with its soil being declared pure. Booty has been made lawful for me. I have been given victory through the inspiring of awe at the distance of a month's journey. I have been given permission to intercede. And I have been sent to all humankind, and the prophets have been sealed with me. Now, this is a Muslim tradition. What it does is that it brings about the discussion about Khatm al-Awliya, who is the seal of the saints. And how can one become the seal of the saints? Najmuddin Daya is one of the authors of the works that deals with the sainthood. And there you find the tradition of the Prophet is always the first one that begins with the discussion about the saintliness. Who are the saints? And how can you become the saint of saints? That's sense.
Date, relationship to hadith, and question, is this the earliest occurrence of the term seal of the prophets?
Yes. That means there is no prophet after Muhammad.
No, is this the earliest occurrence of this term?
No. It is in the Quran itself.
Oh, okay. So, all right. Fine.
But that Quranic term is open to interpretation, by the way. Khatam or Khatam also means ring. It also means signet. So you can move in any way, because after the death of the Prophet, there were several other prophets who developed, who claimed to be the prophets. But the community made what we call an ijma, a consensus, there will be no prophethood after Muhammad. So that's the way it interpreted that particular verse in the Quran. But here you have a very different meaning, that seal of the prophets is also the seal of the saints in some ways. Muhammad's position then is increased from the seal of the prophets. He also becomes the seal of the saints, which is a higher position because intercession. You can see I have been given victory through the inspiring of awe. This is the what I call the political power, the political authority. But the spiritual one is very, very much connected with the intercession. And the prophets have been sealed with me. I'm bringing this text in between this so that it becomes clear to you that we are moving in through the historical development. But through the text, we understand that this is how they conceived the role of the prophet in the community. How it moved from the legislator to the sainthood. The booty in the warfare. When I go in the warfare, if I fight the war, whatever is left by the, whatever we take from the enemy is lawful to us. Yes, it was. I don't know. I have to hear from the scholars of the biblical tradition. Was it lawful for them or it was not lawful for them? Because there is another tradition. Can the prophets take prisoners, for example?
And the Quran says the prophets can't take prisoners. Prisoners of war. Yes, that means there is no prophet after me. I'm the final one.
Not that I know of.
But prophets aren't a category vis-a-vis booty. Booty, whatever happens to the army, happens to anyone there. There's no special reference. There's no special legal status to a prophet. In any.
The only reference you have that's in any way analogous is a decision made by David for the distribution of booty for his troops. If you think of David as a prophet, and if you think of this as a binding precedent, maybe there's a connection. That's it.
Because there is a verse in the Quran, "Inna lillahi khumusun wa li rasuli." The fifth of the booty was assigned to the prophet. And this was a common Arabic practice, by the way. In the Arab tribal system, the Arab tribal commander who went to the war took one-fifth of the booty and four-fifths was divided among the warriors. So he's making a reference to that I had a special privilege of having that one-fifth given to me as a booty. That's the reference in the Quran, by the way, about the spoils of the war. How the spoils of the war. But it's an interesting tradition coming at that time, you know. And it raises so many legal issues connected with the tradition. But again, we are looking at it more in reference to the saintly thing. What is the intercession doing there? What I have here is an image which would be very beautiful if there was complete darkness here. Can anybody see here properly? No, even the light is coming on this side. If only there was something to... I don't think we can really enhance it. This is, by the way, one of the very important traditions about Mi'raj and in connection to Jerusalem. This is where it begins. This is the Mi'raj of the Prophet, the ascension of Muhammad in the heavens from Sakhra. From Qubbat al-Sakhra. The Sakhra there is the place from which he ascended. And Aqsa is where he prayed. That's what the tradition says. So horizontally he traveled from Mecca to Jerusalem, miraculously. And then vertically he traveled from the Sakhra upward in the heaven. This is a very strong tradition in Sufism also. But generally in Islam, Isra, Yawm al-Isra, Laylatul Isra, or the night of the Isra, is celebrated as the night of Muhammad's journey into the heavens. But there's also a mystical dimension to it. Now if you see it here, there's a miraculous horse. It's known as Buraq. Even if you go today in the Sakhra here, in Jerusalem, they show the hoof of the animal that on whom he had climbed. So that's what they show it. This Buraq has a woman's face, but it has also wings. It was a special horse that had come. And therefore in India or Pakistan, in the Muslim homes, you might see a picture of Buraq hanging on the walls as a very special blessing. They use this Buraq. By the way, Buraq also means electrifying. Baraka, Barq is electricity. So that's how Buraq is. But there are angels all around accompanying. And Gabriel is the one who's taking Muhammad into the heavens. But let's see the connection, interfaith connections in the tradition of Mi'raj. There are two dimensions that we must pay attention to in the story of Mi'raj. The night journey and ascension. There's one possibility that is underscored by the tradition of Mi'raj. In a beautiful tradition, and I think it's one of the very original traditions going back to the early days of Muhammad's life. As-salatu mi'rajul mu'mineen. Daily prayer is a spiritual ascension of a person who prays. So prayer is also regarded as an experience of ascension in spirituality. So Mi'raj is regarded as a very important moment. In the seventh year of his prophethood, he experienced the Mi'raj.
And Miraj has an experience that we today are able to see it, and there are descriptions of, there are hundreds of books celebrating Miraj, Miraj Name, Qissat al-Isra, the story of Isra, what happened, how the Prophet went, and what did he see. It has become a model of ecstatic human life, in which human being can live a single moment through years. That experience of ecstasy in the Miraj is regarded as something extremely important in the moment of our own spiritual growth, our own spiritual development. Muhammad's experience has been regarded as a paradigm of any Muslim's spiritual journey. In order to become the sadhu, in order to become the zahid, as they call them, the ascetic, you can experience Miraj every time that you pray with God, to pray to God. So each moment of salat, 5 times a day, you can experience the moment of Miraj, because it is an initiated experience, but it can't be repeated conscientiously. Consciously you can't do it. It comes as a gift. The moments are captured. There is also an important dimension to it. How close can human beings be to God? Miraj has been regarded as Kaaba wa Qawsain. Kaaba wa Qawsain is as close as the arrow is to the bow. That kind of closeness with God is possible in Miraj. Can you see that the Quran does not underline these kinds of close experiences? But on the other hand, the tradition of Miraj in the Quran itself is, special ones of revelation are this which is otherwise beings to achieve at any level with God. God is God, human beings are human beings. How close can you come to human being? And the story of Miraj ends into the request. The Prophet says, remove your veil, O my Lord. He said, no, you will not be able to stand it. We just sent a spark to Moses, and he and his companions, they all fell on the ground. They could not take it. So you will also not be able to take it. So the story of Miraj connects with the story of Moses receiving the revelation, and how that experience was. I'm talking about the Quran. I'm still very weak in my biblical studies. I'm reading every day, but I'm referring to the Quranic story where Moses sees the light of God in the bush, and then there is another story in the Quran whereby Moses comes. I have these companions who will see you, and God says, "Lan tarani, you will never be able to see me." But oh my God, what can I do? What can I say to these people? They want to see you. And the light sparks and they all burn in the light. And then Moses prays to God that please bring them back to life. And this is how the miracle is reported in the Quran. So I'm talking about the Quranic tradition. I don't know if there is any resonance to any kind of biblical story anywhere. I don't know. Yes. A little bit? Yes.
A little bit. It's a combination of some Bible, some Midrash, and probably some original take on the two.
So that's where the Miraj story connects to the story of the other prophets. Miraj is a movement. Araja is to climb. Therefore, Miraj also means a ladder. A ladder through which you climb a higher position. Urj, araj. Okay, also reveals the distinction between a prophet and a mystic. Miraj also gives us an indication how a prophet is different from a mystic. Prophet returns to the society because he's leading them, he's guiding them. Whereas the other shuns the relation to the world and his people. Many a times the mystic does not want to come back to the society. And therefore it's very interesting that in the Khatmul Wilaya, I have this passage in which the author, Ash-Shibli, and others who have written this, they talk about the necessity of the saint to come back to the society. A saint is the one who comes back to the society and does not shun the society. Because he is needed in the society as a model. He should be the one to inspire the people. How can he remain away from the society? So this is one of the distinctions given between a prophet, Mother and Nabi. What is a prophet? The prophet is the one who does experience the mirage and comes back to the society. Whereas a mystic might experience the ecstasy but would never return.
Who gives this distinction?
To come back because he would shun the society.
You said this is given by whom?
By
who makes this distinction between mystic and prophet in this way?
The scholars of mysticism.
Shibli.
Shibli and others who have written books on the sainthood.
What period?
Most of them are medieval.
Okay.
Most of them are medieval. Well, most of the texts on Sufism go back to 10th, 11th, and 12th century. So 10th, 11th, 12th century is also regarded as the classical age of Islamic tradition. But it also somehow overlaps with the medieval age where you have most of the commentaries being written on the earlier pronouncements on about the sainthood. So the mystical experience itself could be experienced by anyone potentially, but the prophets, when they experience it, they come back. Some of the mystics might not come back. I think the yoga that one takes up, one shuns the very idea of coming back to the society. One has reached that stage of chitta, and this is how, at least in Islam, you find that there is a lot of interaction between Hindu mysticism, Buddhist mysticism, and Islamic mysticism at this level. There's a lot of exchange going on. Okay, Muhammad and other prophets, Miraj tradition is also extremely important of how Muhammad is connected to the other prophets. Yes, the Quran says about these things, but what is the role of these other prophets in the development of Muslim religiosity? Miraj actually functions as an encounter between Islam and other previous prophets. Because at each level of the journey that is described in great details in Islam, you find that the prophet of Islam is meeting the other prophets. So we see, for example, Muhammad meets Jesus in the fourth heaven, Abraham in the seventh, Moses in the third. And all prophets, according to this tradition, enjoy the protection from sinful deviation. That is, Isma is connected with all of them. This is description in this. There are seven heavens and seven earths. There are layers of the heavens. Sab'a samawat is used in the Quran. This seven, by the way, has no literal meaning. In Arabic, seven also means more layers. Seven is the number that indicates a large number, several, so to speak. There is no. Yes, there is a hierarchy of the levels of the heavens, and you achieve as a reward different layers. You go to the different. You are assigned to the different levels of heaven, of
paradise. The judgment of value in that statement.
Yes, I think there is something like that. I'm not pretty sure though, because Moses is also mentioned in some other traditions of the fifth heaven. So that's why I'm a little concerned that maybe it is not true that it is hierarchical. But Abraham being put on the seventh level, the highest one, appears to be some kind of hierarchy. But I'm not very sure. I've not read it anywhere, so I really cannot say that for sure that's what this interpretation is. Yes?
I think I have a footnote on the number seven when I'm going to talk about the Saint Andal one of these days. She says that she will serve the Lord for seven times seven lives, which is equal to eternity.
Yeah.
And this number seven actually goes all the way through the Indian tradition back into the Rig Veda. And we think it probably was there in the Indus Valley civilization, and it was a connection with the constellations at that point of time.
How about in the biblical literature? Is it there, seven, number seven?
Well, no, I have to turn that.
What did you ask?
Number seven, seven heavens, seven...
Well, the model of seven heavens... Well, let's back up a second, okay? The notion of ascent and descent is very well established throughout the entire ancient world. Even though it's not a very prominent motif in the Bible, it's very popular in pagan literature. You have it in Egypt, you have it in Mesopotamia, you have it in Canaan, you have it in Greece. Okay, and you have it in post-biblical Jewish literature as well, conceivably as a way of associating this well-known motif from the ancient world that wasn't very important in the Bible, but it comes back. And so you do have extensive discussions of ascent of Moses to heaven, for example, in Apocrypha, Pseudepigrapha, and later in rabbinic literature. I think that what one has to do here is to draw the connection between the image of seven heavens, which is specifically available in a lot of pre-Islamic Jewish literature.
Yes.
I mean, this is clearly a model that he borrowed and then used for his. What I'm curious about is what's in the seventh heaven, or more specifically, what's the top? Okay, because in Jewish literature, there are two different versions of this.
Yes.
In a book called Sefer HaRazim, which is really a very early book of Jewish magic.
Right.
There are seven heavens with angels in all the different levels.
Right.
And then on top of the seventh heaven is God. Okay? So in effect, there's an eighth level. Okay?
Yeah,
and I'm curious whether in Islam you have God at the top or something else, above
God
the seven.
God is at the top. This is the model that we have. Seventh is the highest and God is...
Okay,
about
so that's parallel to some of the Jewish texts too.
Yeah. But you said there's another tradition that goes the other way? Then?
Yeah, you have both ways.
Oh, okay. I think there is unanimous understanding at least in the Islamic traditional sources, that the seventh heaven is the highest level, and then you have God above it. Philosophers go the other way. The first intellect and the second intellect, they come down in what we call the elimination and the theory of creation from top to the bottom. And then they come at the seventh level is the lunar, what we call sphere. So they talk, and it's more Hellenistic. Whereas the Quran itself, sab asamawat, also has the meaning, as I say, of not literally seven, but several layers of it. And each one then, so the journey is a transformation of an individual from the lower level of the self to the higher level of the self. So Mi'raj has become a prototype of the individual personal growth from the lower level to the higher level. And it also indicates the human potential, that how human beings can travel from the lower to the highest possible level that there is available to them.